You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our SmartCast microlearning podcast series titled Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in NAMD and DME to Lower Treatment Burden and Improve Outcomes, an expansion of the Vision Relief No Eyes Left Behind initiative. This series is hosted by Dr. David Eichenbaum, a collaborative associate professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine, and Director of Research, Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida in St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. David Eichenbaum, and I will be the host of today's podcast, Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in Neovascular Macular Degeneration and Diabetic Macular Edema to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes. This is a four-part podcast talking about unmet needs in neovascular macular degeneration and diabetic macular edema treatment, addressing treatment burden. Today, I'm going to be focusing on unmet needs in NAMD and DME treatment. A couple of key points that we're going to think about in the ensuing conversation is understanding different needs in anti-VEGF therapy for NAMD and DME. We're going to review the gaps that all of us see in our practices when treating patients with anti-VEGF or biologic therapy, review the unmet needs that have the greatest impact on our patients' vision and visual outcomes, and lastly, review approaches to meeting the individual needs of patients, such as dosing strategies and the potential that next generation anti-VEGF therapy can offer our patients.
So Dr. Eichenbaum, what unmet needs do you see in your daily practice for the treatment of NAMD and DME?
So the biggest unmet need in both of these common retinal disease states is the need for more durability between injections. Both patients with NAMD and DME require a frequent injection treatment regimen to achieve their best visual function. And then especially with our older agents, ongoing frequent intravitreal injections to maintain whatever their best visual function may be. The second great unmet need we have is access to care, especially in DME patients. DME patients need broader access to retina doctors, to biologic therapeutics, to all facets of healthcare, because many of them are younger than the Medicare age population. Because of that difficulty with access, the DME patients often have more difficulty adhering to their care, and I think more durable therapies meeting the unmet need of reducing the frequency of injections would allow these patients who are especially at risk of dropping off, the DME patients, do better overall.
What other aspects of visual function are most important to assess and address for NAMD and DME patients?
So visual acuity is a great measure of visual function because it is exceedingly objective. It's numeric, and we can compare it visit to visit. We can look at it in clinical trials, and it has a very important role in assessing visual function. However, the world is not a visual acuity chart. The world is not an ETDRS chart or a Snellen chart. The world is full of different ways that we use our vision. In the clinic, it's difficult to formally assess different parameters of visual function, but we know that visual function such as contrast sensitivity, such as facial recognition speed, different things other than visual acuity are things that our patients need to be able to do to read, to drive, to watch television, and perform other activities of daily living. And the best way to assess those visual functions outside of clinical trials is to talk to patients about how they're doing. You know, a patient seeing 20/32 with a dry macula probably has very different visual function than a patient reading 20/32 with a macula full of fluid. So even though we don't see the patients losing vision, I strive to have my patients have good quantized visual function with regards to acuity and good qualitative visual function with regards to how they're doing. And I tie that to good anatomic control.
What are your biggest challenges related to these unmet needs?
Oh, the challenges to unmet needs. That's a whole Pandora's box of stuff. I think the most modifiable would be improving access to second generation therapies. We have a lot of onerous prior authorizations and benefits investigation requirements before we can achieve open access for our patients with managed Medicare or commercial insurance. And that's a tremendous unmet need, is access to these medications, the best medications that the patients can get. And my philosophy is to get the best medication for the patient to the patient's eye as soon as possible. So getting through those barriers would be important. And recently we published a paper regarding prior authorizations and how they're basically futile with regards to obstructing access, but they're very effective at delaying access. So getting rid of those would be wonderful at improving access. Additionally, challenges to unmet needs are patients' out-of-pocket costs. We do have a whole bunch of services provided by the manufacturers of drugs to reduce the out-of-pocket costs, such as access programs that help with the co-pays. We also have grant foundations like Good Days that offer funding for patients to reduce their out-of-pocket costs. And additionally, getting to the office for these patients. If they're NAMD patients, they're old and infirm. If they're DME patients, they have all the problems we alluded to earlier with multiple doctor's visits. They're often of working age. They often have parents or children or both that need them for various other family duties or health duties. So getting to the office frequently is a real gap that these patients have as a challenge when they're trying to come and maintain their visual function. So those are the three biggest things we see, is access to medication, out-of-pocket cost, and getting to the office. Those are challenges to patients adhering to treatment and having their best possible outcome.
How do you leverage next generation therapy to address these needs?
So the next generation therapies that we're referring to in this question are aflibercept HD or 8 milligram and faricimab, which is anti-angiogenic and an anti-VEGF and anti-Ang2 mechanism of action drug. Those are the two second generation therapies or next generation therapies that we're talking about. We were involved in the registration trials for both of those and the phase 2 trials for faricimab. And what we saw when we published the results of those trials as part of the collaborative multicenter studies were that the patients did better with longer gaps between treatments. In the real world, what we're seeing through both small real-world presentations, which we've done from our group in collaboration with a practice in Wisconsin, looking at aflibercept 8 milligram, and what's been done on an even larger scale, looking at databases for faricimab, is that patients are doing well with these new drugs and achieving longer intervals in the real world between their injections. And what I hope to do over the next 12 to 24 to 36 months is these drugs, aflibercept 8 milligram or aflibercept HD and faricimab, remain sort of at the top of the commercially available pyramid, is convert more patients to these drugs or start more patients on these drugs with the goal of extending their intervals between visits and allowing them to retain their best visual acuity, first gain, then retain their best visual acuity without having to come in and see me quite as much.
So what do you think about the relaunch of the ranibizumab port delivery system?
We were involved in the phase 2, phase 3, and extension studies of the ranibizumab port delivery system, and I've had the good fortune to be a surgeon on a few dozen implantations and several hundred refill exchanges. So I've got a good amount of experience with that product, but it is not without its own unique caveats and risks and requirements for a patient who understands what its benefits and its limitations are. It is a surgical implantation. The surgery is not much more difficult or easier than other things that we do in the vitreoretinal operating room. It does have a couple of awkward steps, but all of which can be learned, and there's robust support from the manufacturer to teach you how to do that. The refill exchanges similarly require a little bit of practice, and there is a learning curve there. The patients who get the port delivery system, as long as they don't have any of the adverse events, don't require much more treatment, either in the study population or in our limited real-world experience with its brief commercial life before the recall and the recent relaunch. than the refills that they get every 6 months or perhaps even less often. The downside is there are surgical problems with it. It does have a black box warning for endophthalmitis because there was about a 2% incidence of endophthalmitis in the registration trial. That incidence is dropping in the first real-world report of the port delivery system, which was presented at clinical trials at the summit and I was a co-author on. I think that the incidence ought to continue to drop as it is surgical, and as surgeons, we get better with time.
How do your patients' unmet needs impact your practice and treatment decisions?
So my philosophy, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation regarding patients, is to get the patient the best drug for their condition to them in their eye as quickly as possible. And the patient's needs of reducing treatment burden drive me and many of the members in my practice, especially since we have a lot of experience with these drugs pre-commercially, to use the newest products with the longest duration sooner in the patient's treatment courses. And I believe that that does set the patient up for the best success anatomically, and the best success with regards to injection burden. And our experience as an investigative site and then our early commercial experience with these drugs leads us to use more and more of the second generation agents in our practice.
What resources or support services have you found most helpful for patients managing the psychosocial impact of vision loss?
Patients get very depressed when they lose vision. Fortunately, with neovascular macular degeneration and diabetic macular edema, we don't see nearly as much of that as we did even when I was training in the mid-2000s. The proliferation of biologics and better corticosteroids has reduced this sad situation profoundly in the U.S. and throughout the world. When we do have a patient who loses vision, and we all have patients who still lose vision to common retinal disease, I think what's really changed since I started practice is the accessibility of virtual support groups. If I have a patient who's doing poorly, either the patient or their family member can often find a Facebook group or some other social media group to give them a source of constant support. The traditional legacy services that we have, which help patients with the psychosocial impact of vision loss and depression, include groups that meet at the Lighthouse. We have a Lighthouse for the Blind facility and an active chapter of patients who meet there in our market for folks with vision loss who want to talk about it. And many of the facilities that our older patients live in, our neovascular macular degeneration patients, have support groups for folks who've lost vision. And a lot of our patients meet live in those support groups to talk about that. But the big thing and the new thing are people who have community online related to their vision loss. And we see that mostly with folks who are a little bit younger than our most elderly patients, but they're happy to have that accessibility to community. I can see how that helps with the psychosocial impact of vision loss.
Tell me more about the pipeline for potential therapies coming for NAMD or DME.
So it's a very exciting year for common retinal disease. It seems that most late phase programs are starting in macular degeneration since that's their most prescribed indication. That makes sense. But we have two tyrosine kinase inhibitor programs, two intravitreal gene therapy programs, which have kicked off or are kicking off imminently phase three registration studies. We have a subretinal gene therapy program for wet AMD, which is mostly enrolled its phase three study. And all of these technologies can translate to diabetic macular edema. We may very well see an approval soon for the port delivery system in diabetic macular edema. And it's a good time to be a patient because a lot of these things are coming, and it's a great time to be a retina specialist because it's very, very exciting. You know, there are even some novel MOAs and earlier phase development in DME. We're looking at a phase two study looking at something completely different than VEGF inhibition, looking at something that's truly coming from another angle in the Wnt pathway. So there's a lot of exciting stuff that we've got in mid-phase and late-phase clinical trial, and I can't wait to see what shakes out. Another important thing to always remember with your patients, especially your patients who have diabetes, if they come in with diabetic retinopathy, you have to remind them that we have technology that has never been as good as it is now for controlling their diabetes. We have smartphone integrated glucose monitoring systems. We have pumps that interact with those and act kind of like an external pancreas to some extent. All of that is profoundly improving the public health of folks with diabetes. We have new classes of diabetes modulating medications, GLP-1 drugs that have gotten a lot of press. For a macular degeneration, we're moving our clinical science into intermediate dry AMD. There's nothing proven in phase 3 with a result yet to reduce the rate of dry AMD advancement from intermediate to advanced. But we are looking at elamipretide. We're looking at oral medication. CLNP3 is a study looking at oral medication for intermediate dry AMD. There are a lot of things looking at preventing the advancement of disease to more advanced stages, geographic atrophy or NAMD or diabetes progressing to diabetic macular edema. A lot of these things are investigational, but from a practical standpoint regarding those two common retinal diseases, you got so many tools for your patients to control their diabetes that it's always beneficial, I think, to talk to the patients and make sure they know that you're encouraging them to do a good job medically. Thank you very much for listening with us today. Being able to offer our patients therapeutic options that work for them, enabling them to get the best visual outcome, is why we, as retina specialists, do this job. I look forward to delving deeper into the different barriers to adherence with anti-VEGF therapy in our next episode with Dr. Priya Vakharia. We appreciate the time you took to consider these issues with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Eichenbaum, for joining us today. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Please join us again soon for another episode in this series discussing strategies to reduce the treatment burden and improve outcomes for NAMD and DME. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And a special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity.